The court will resume in the matter of Zuniga versus State, which is case number 58267. Ms. Thomas, Ms. Fleck, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Jonelle Thomas. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Valentin Zuniga. I'm hoping to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I know the court is familiar with the facts and the issues that are raised in the brief. Unless the court would like to address other issues, I plan to focus on three issues this morning: the abuse of the grand jury process, the closing argument, and the sentence of life without the possibility of parole. I presented a number of issues concerning cell site location information records. The Fourth Amendment issue in particular is very interesting. There's a split of authority across the country. The U.S. Supreme Court recently weighed in on a similar issue in the Jones decision of last year. It's going to be interesting to see where that all comes out. But I think ultimately that it's far easier and more straightforward to resolve this issue under the state statutory issue, which concerns the use of the grand jury process to obtain these records. In 1985, the legislature enacted NRS 172.107, and it declared what had already been the universal rule, which is that the grand jury process is not to be used for gaining discovery in a case that's already pending before the district court. I don't see that this court has ever addressed that statute. It may be that it's so simple and straightforward and so common sense oriented that there's never been a need, but in this case, that statute was violated. The prosecutor here, although the case was pending in district court as of December of 2009, went to the grand jury judge in 2010 and in January and obtained a subpoena to obtain records which under a federal statute required judge's order.
Is there any truth, at least to the assertion that is set forth in this case, that they were that there was other matters under investigation that would have therefore allowed that reference to or access to the grand jury?
There is certainly nothing in the record to support that assertion. When this issue was brought up in the district court, the prosecutors did not claim that there was a grand jury proceeding that was pending. I can't imagine what other charges could have been brought by a grand jury under the facts of this case. Certainly, the defendant had not received a Markham notice. There was no indication at any time that this case was proceeding before a grand jury. And one would have expected when this issue was raised in the district court that had there actually been grand jury proceedings, the trial prosecutors would have said so. But they didn't, and I think the silence of the record confirms that indeed there were no grand jury proceedings. At best, this could be remanded for an evidentiary hearing on that issue. But I think given the state of the record here, the court can be confident that there were no grand jury proceedings. Based upon these facts, that evidence should not have been admitted at trial, in addition to the other Fourth Amendment issues that we have presented. I also submit that those records were highly prejudicial on the facts of this case. These records were the subject of testimony by two witnesses, a detective and a Metro PCS custodian of records. There were exhibits, there were maps. It was the subject of extensive discussion. Unlike many or most of the other witnesses in this case, these witnesses did not suffer from the same credibility and personal relationship and other issues that would interfere with their objectivity. And they were likely carried great weight with the jury because they didn't suffer from those same issues. Certainly, they were the focus of a substantial portion of the closing argument, and I think that they had a substantial influence upon the jury's verdict. The next issue I would like to discuss concerns the prosecutor's closing argument. I'll acknowledge at the outset that there was no objection to this argument. However, I think it's clear that this was a plainly erroneous, highly unconstitutional, highly improper argument that should never have been made. The argument is set forth in its entirety in the brief. In essence, the prosecutor argued that this case was far different than any other case in the judicial system. Civil, criminal, misdemeanor, other brutal murders, that this case stood out as being unique because all of those other cases are about a search for the truth, whereas in this case, defense counsel was focused upon whether the state had met its burden of proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt. That, of course, is nonsense. This case is just like every other case in the criminal justice system. Every case concerns a burden of proof and whether the party has met that burden, the opposing party arguing that it is not. To falsely suggest that defense counsel was doing something wrong here, that they were arguing contrary to every other case in the judicial system by focusing on the reasonable doubt standard, went to the very fundamentals and essence of our criminal justice system. That argument has never been okay. That argument could never be okay. I researched, I looked and looked for a case that says don't do this, but sometimes things are so basic and so fundamental that there's no need to put them in a court opinion. And that's what we have here. We have an argument that was the first argument that the prosecutor made in the rebuttal argument. So it set the tone for the rest of his argument. And it disparaged defense counsel on illegitimate grounds and argued that they were doing something wrong by focusing on the burden of proof. I ask this court to find that that argument was improper, to find that it invalidated every other aspect of the case by striking right at the heart of the jury's deliberations, and to reverse on those grounds. The last issue I'd like to discuss concerns the sentence of life without the possibility of parole. I recognize that for a very long time now, this court has held that the trial courts are invested with great discretion in imposing a sentence. This court gives great deference to those decisions. As far as I can find, this originated in 1978 in the Schmidt decision. In 1978, a sentence of life without did not mean life without. A defendant could work hard, prove that he had changed, work diligently at becoming a new person, and could present his case to the pardons board. In some other instances, the prison might put a person with a life without on the pardons board agenda and state because of a medical condition, infirmary, or other factors that the defendant should be given a chance of parole. The pardons board could have mercy, grant some clemency, and allow that person to go to the parole board. In 1995, that changed when the law was enacted saying that life without means life without. It took away the pardons board's power to do anything with such a sentence. And it took away the fail-safe in our system of making sure the life without sentence was truly appropriate. And so now today, I'm asking you to not give the great deference in cases of life without. I'm asking you to review this for an abuse of discretion, recognizing that you are the last chance that a defendant has who is sentenced to a life without sentence to have review. I think in this limited circumstance that the normal sentencing discretion should be limited. Certainly the district court should still retain discretion, but the great deference should not be given, both so that the defendant has one last chance of showing that he should have a glimmer of hope of getting out of prison, but also so that the taxpayers of this state are not stuck with the financial consequences of a life without sentence. Mr. Zuniga was 18 years old when this happened. He was 19 at the time he was sentenced. Even if he was given a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, he would not be able to get out until he was 48 years old, at a time when he may be a far different person than he is now, far more mature and insightful. He could be a completely different person. He didn't have prior criminal felony charges or convictions at the time of this offense, and even the district court recognized that this action took place as an emotional reaction to his girlfriend who was manipulating him. And I think the record is clear on the immaturity, the lack of judgment that was present in this offense. This case is not a life without case. There is not more than one victim. This was a young man who deserves to have that glimmer of hope. That's not saying the parole board would ever let him out, but he should be given that opportunity. I believe here that the district court abused its discretion in imposing the life without sentence, and I ask this court to reverse that decision by making it a life with. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Thomas, I trust Justice Sada will allow you to have the full amount of your time for rebuttal.
I'm pretty close.
But I would like to ask your thoughts.
Certainly.
And your colleagues' thoughts on the status of the test of expectation of privacy under, in light of Jones and the positions taken there by the United States Supreme Court, a test that seems to have been fairly stable in our jurisprudence until Jones. And now you've got the Graham and the Skinner case that the state provided to us in supplemental briefing, and which seem to rely themselves on expectation of privacy. What make you of the status of the test for Fourth Amendment assessments now?
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that Jones was a very important case in this line of authority on expectations of privacy. It will probably come as no surprise that I find Justice Sotomayor's concurrence to be especially compelling. And I would urge the court to follow her analysis. The split of authority of the court between the Scalia opinions and the Alito opinions is interesting, certainly as the property rights, but I don't think any of the justices forecloses the relief that we are seeking here, which would be a finding that the citizens of this country have an expectation of privacy in not being tracked by the state, subject to basically a personal tracking device that 90% of the population now carries in their pockets. The reasonable person on the street would not see carrying a cell phone as a license for the government to track their every move. Certainly the citizens of Nevada would not find such, and I urge this court to find it as a matter of state constitutional right that our citizens would find such a violation. And I think it's important to note here, we're not saying those records can never be found or discovered or provided to the state. We're saying that the state should have to get a search warrant. The state should have to present probable cause to warrant that level of government intrusion. And essentially, I think that's what it boils down to, but the expectation of privacy issue may have been well settled before Jones, arguably not. The third party disclosure issue may have been more settled before Jones. I think Jones is a fundamental change in how we look at these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. On behalf of the state, Ms. Fleck.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Fleck and I represent the state of Nevada in the case against Valentin Zuniga. Starting in 2006, the appellant, Valentin Zuniga, started telling people that he wanted to kill Julian Roman. Again in 2009, started saying the exact same thing. In the days and weeks prior to the murder, he armed himself with a gun, with ammunition, and with the address to Julian Roman's house. At the scene of the crime, his car, a very unique car, is seen by no less than 5 people. After the murder, he not only discloses to friends, but shows that he's committed this murder, but he also shows those friends the murder weapon. After he's arrested, he gives a chilling, detailed confession to his friend, Edgar Santillan. There was an overwhelming amount of evidence in this case, and I haven't even mentioned the cell phone records. Appellant has spent the majority of the brief and the first issue today discussing the grand jury subpoena, obviously then to get those cell phone records. But what's important is that at trial, while in the appeal, the cell phone records have become the topic and the most important issue. Actually, at trial, they were some of the least compelling evidence in the voluminous, damaging evidence that we had against Mr. Zuniga for this particular murder.
Counsel, can you concede error then in the use of the subpoena?
No, I don't concede error in the use of this subpoena. Basically, what happened is we went to preliminary hearing in the end of December. A couple of weeks later, as you know, the subpoena issued through Detective Freeman. The statute reads that a district attorney shall not use the grand jury in order to get this information. A district attorney shall not, and in this case, a district attorney did not. It was not done by either Mr. Tomczyk or myself, or with our knowledge. That being said, it's information that we could have gotten regardless. When that grand jury subpoena was issued and we got the records for it, that was all disclosed to the defense. It was never the subject of a motion to suppress. It was never the subject of any kind of exclusion. So unfortunately, there's very little record about what happened, process that Detective Freeman went through, and whether or not he actually had another reason, or if, as the federal law says, or points to the sole or dominant purpose was for this particular defendant. What happened at trial is, while I was questioning the expert from Metro PCS, the defense objected on Fourth Amendment grounds. The court then overruled the objection to the records coming in on Fourth Amendment grounds, ruling rightfully, that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy in those records based upon third-party doctrine. The fact that they were business records of the cell phone company, the defendant had no reasonable expectation of privacy, therefore, objection overruled and evidence comes in. It isn't until the next day, after Metro PCS has testified, after the records have come in, that then defense counsel comes forward and says, actually, there was an issue because after the grand jury, this subpoena issued. So based upon that, we have no real information about what the detective gleaned from preliminary hearing, which was quite a bit. We called, I think 10 witnesses. And if it was his sole or dominant purpose in getting this grand jury subpoena. Regardless, the fact of the matter is, it's harmless error. I mean, these records come in, and that's probably why defense counsel never objected pre-trial. They're coming in through this grand jury subpoena. If, in fact, he violated the statute by submitting for the subpoena a couple weeks after the information has come down, then he gets a search warrant. Months before, in September, he had already applied for and gotten a search warrant for the actual cell phone, as well as all of the contents within the cell phone. So there's probable cause. Additionally, it's kind of a circular argument at this point because now it's been bound up to district court, so clearly there's probable cause to believe that this defendant committed this crime.
I'd like to return your attention to the interpretation of NRS 172-107. The way I read that statute, it seems to read, to me at least, and I'm offering this so that you can state your position, that it seems to operate as a bar against the district attorney's use of any of this material, regardless of how it is obtained, when these circumstances exist. So even if, as you argue, the detective obtained the subpoena from the grand jury without your knowledge and participation. The statute, read more broadly, would seem to prohibit the use of the evidence that's obtained, and frankly, regardless of whether there's a sole or dominant purpose attached to it. What's your view of that interpretation of the statute?
Well, I would respectfully disagree. The reading that I take from that is a district attorney shall not use a grand jury to discover. So my interpretation would be shall not use the grand jury process to discover additional evidence. And I think that something to support that would be the remedies that are available if there is violation of these kinds of statutes. And exclusion conceded by the appellant or suppression is not an available remedy. The available remedies for violating this kind of a statute has been civil actions or some sort of an administrative action, but not suppression. So I would respectfully disagree that that statute says that that evidence cannot then be used. And especially in a case like this where, based upon the fact that clearly the detective is not using the lower standard of specific and articulable facts in order to usurp his higher standard of probable cause. So it was done in good faith. He's not trying to do something through the grand jury that he couldn't otherwise do through an actual search warrant.
Assuming the panel agreed with that interpretation of the statute, then that takes us to the constitutional question about any Fourth Amendment abridgment in the absence of a search warrant and your position with respect to what appear to be some competing approaches to this this constitutional question.
Okay.
And I'm particularly concerned about how we approach this issue in light of the various opinions in Jones.
Okay. Well, straight away I would suggest that in this particular case and in all cases involving historic cell site data, that the third party doctrine should apply. And that's what we see in the most recent case of U.S. v. Graham, which is that, number one, a defendant in this case would not have standing because these are records that are owned and held by Metro PCS or by the business. In Miller, we see the bank records, in Smith, the pen register, the number of cases that have come out, I think, Bynum and Perini, that talk about internet service, IP addresses, that, number one, the appellant would not have standing to even challenge these the use of these records or any flaw in the discovery of them. And that, more importantly, he has no reasonable expectation of privacy that society is willing to accept because these are records that are held by a third party. And to voluntarily convey any information, voluntarily convey your whereabouts, your cell phone activity, to a company who obviously is compiling that data, is using that data to then reach out to you for billing, for any other questions that you may have about your cell phone service, that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy. To juxtapose it then to the Jones case that I know that you're interested in, that I think is entirely different because that was not only real-time monitoring, which, you know, as you know from Skinner, now we've kind of gotten a little bit of a mix because in Skinner, the GPS was found to be a reasonable, that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy. But in Jones, the issue being that it was the trespass of law enforcement without a search warrant and putting a piece of technology onto the vehicle that allowed law enforcement to real-time track without without the search warrant, and that without that real-time tracker, they would not otherwise be able to follow the defendant.
But it seems the test the U.S. Supreme Court pursued in Jones makes it very difficult to address in cases like this where, for example, suppose the tracking was a drone as opposed to a device placed on the outside of the vehicle.
Are you referring to my specific case or to
the test that we should be considering? It seems to me the Supreme Court has muddled this Fourth Amendment test involving expectation of privacy.
Well, I don't think so in terms of this, you know, in GPS situations.
The argument that's being made, as I understand it, by Ms. Thomas, is that we have no expectation of privacy for vehicles on the roads. But we have an expectation of privacy with respect to the cell locators that would identify our location. The Jones case seems to suggest, without using expectation of privacy, now they resort to trespass, that if the government somehow trespasses on your vehicle by placing something on the outside, that that's a Fourth Amendment violation. So my question is, what is the expectation of privacy? What's the viability of that test? Or are we supposed to look at trespass? And is there a trespass committed when a drone is following your vehicle, for example?
Well, I think that if you look then to the Skinner case, the most recent on this kind of GPS issue, it would be if the person purposefully or voluntarily availed themselves to piece of technology that in something like Jones, where law enforcement went and put that technology in the vehicle to track, as opposed to something like Skinner.
Well, if we take the argument full circle, most agreements with cell providers, under the third-party argument you make, contain an agreement that the third party will maintain this information private and confidential. So isn't there an expectation of privacy on the part of the cell owner with their cell company?
I would suggest that a expectation of, and again, you know, I don't know, since this wasn't addressed, there's nothing actually in the record to know what the contract was or is and how that's highlighted. If there is something like that, I would again suggest that an expectation of privacy, not to relay that to anybody, not to put on the internet on an open access website what your self information is much different than in a case like this where there's criminal activity. I think that some of the recent cases have said there's a difference between someone's subjective or legitimate expectation in privacy as opposed to your subjective expectation not to get caught.
Had the judge found a Fourth Amendment violation and excluded the two witnesses and the cell phone records, what would have been the prejudice? What's your argument with respect to the prejudice to the defendant?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Had the evidence of the two witnesses and cell records been excluded by the judge, if it were excluded because of some either a statutory violation or a constitutional violation, what would have been the harmless error analysis from your point of view?
Okay, and by the two witnesses, you mean the two people, the detective?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's absolutely no error or prejudice to the defendant in this case. Like I said, these records would have come in, and I guess if you, do you mean if he would have excluded it at trial?
Right.
Again, absolutely nothing. Appellant has referenced that this was an overwhelming part of our evidence, that we spent a significant amount of time. It was a minuscule amount of evidence in our case in the voluminous amounts of evidence against Valentin. In my closing argument, I believe that I placed him somewhere in North Las Vegas. Of course, as we know, cell phone towers, you can't even get very specific. So, and with that,
please finish your thought. Please finish your thought.
It was very brief, and it placed him in North Las Vegas. Additionally, Mr. Tomczyk, same kind of passing, fleeting comment on the whereabouts of Mr. Zuniga. During his conversation or statement, I guess, to the police, he had said that he was going to be at work. And we got that information in that he wasn't actually at work during the time of the murder from his boss and the records that were kept at his place of employment. That information was already in evidence from other records that he had lied, and therefore he was someplace other than where he said he was going to be in that alibi he tried to create. So prejudice to the defendant in this case with the cell phone records? Absolutely none. If this case were remanded and reversed, I believe we would get this evidence, but we would do this, could do this trial again without this evidence, exact same result.
Thank you, Ms. Fleck. And Ms. Thomas, I'm going to give you your entire 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The entire 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honor, I'd like to address a few fundamental issues. Detectives do not present cases to the grand jury. They testify in front of grand juries. They may assist the prosecution in presenting a case to the grand jury, but they certainly do not walk into a grand jury on their own and say, here, let me do some more investigation, especially in a case that has already been bound over following a preliminary hearing and is pending in the district court. It may be easier to get that grand jury subpoena, but it violates Nevada law. That is not a proper process, and certainly the state cannot get around that statute, which is also founded upon the common law and a history in this country of not abusing the grand jury process in that manner, even if we didn't have the statute, by the detective taking these actions instead of the prosecutors. The statute is clear. The grand jury is not to be used in that manner. Certainly here, there is no record that the detective presented any information to the grand jury judge. No affidavit is attached to his application. There's no record of or a transcript saying that probable cause was presented to that judge. There's simply no reason to believe that it was. But the fact is, our statute was violated. That evidence should have been excluded.
I suspect, Ms. Thomas, you would therefore agree with Justice Hardesty's proposition that even if we were to accept the detective using the grand jury in a fashion that you say is still inappropriate and unheard of, frankly.
Absolutely.
That the statute can be interpreted as even if somebody else got it, the DA can't use it. You would agree with that premise?
I'd also like to address the prejudice of that issue. This trial had a number of lay witnesses, all of whom were connected to one party or another. One of the issues concerned some of those witnesses going out and attacking other people and whether that should have been allowed. Certainly, I think it's clear from the record that these were emotional, involved witnesses who had a stake in the game. And certainly the jailhouse informant was not a neutral and detached person. I think the record reflects that he was much more closely aligned with the deceased than he was with the defendant. And so the importance of this evidence isn't in the number of witnesses or even the amount of time. It's that it's a different class of evidence. It's something that appears to be much more objective, much more neutral, much more trustworthy than these other people in the case. And that's why it's so significant. I'd also like to address the Fourth Amendment issue in a little bit more detail. Just in the Jones case, Justice Scalia spends a lot of time talking about the trespass issue. And he resolves the case on that issue. But my reading of his opinion is he does not foreclose other Fourth Amendment issues without trespass. Rather, he says, in this opinion, we just need to look at the trespass plus search. That's a violation, or that's a search. I think if you look at Justice Alito's opinion, especially in light of Justice Sotomayor's concurrence, that they would both heavily emphasize the reasonable expectation of privacy. But I think even Justice Scalia would allow for an analysis under the Fourth Amendment based upon a reasonable expectation of privacy, even in the absence of a trespass. I don't think that reasonable, objective, everyday people in this country expect that their every movement can be tracked by their government. When they're outside their homes, cell phones are inside their homes. Cell phones could be in their place of worship, they could be at a bar, they could be at a girlfriend's house. Certainly cell phones, I think, are far more intrusive than the GPS tracking device at issue in Jones, because they can permeate those private areas. But even if they couldn't, I don't think the people of this country are ready to say that every time you step outside of your home, the government is free to track your every move and keep that information indefinitely just because others might see you. or because you might be communicating with third parties. We don't have cameras and microphones on every light post. We don't expect our government to act as a big brother tracking down our every move. And the fact that they can do so through cell phone records, which are cell site location information is not found on your bill. Many people may not recognize that their cell company is maintaining this information and that they're maintaining it for a very long time, as they must under a government regulation.
Finish your thought, please.
There are not two sets of rules. There is not a Fourth Amendment for the criminals and a Fourth Amendment for the rest of us. We have one Fourth Amendment. It guarantees privacy, and I think that the people of this state, the people of this country, have a reasonable expectation of privacy in these records, and a warrant should be required. Thank you.
Justice Sena, another question for her. Ms. Thomas, if the court were to agree that autopsy reports are testimonial, how would that influence or how would that affect the verdict in this case?
Your Honor, I didn't bring that issue up because I recognize we didn't object at trial, and I recognize that there was testimony that this man was shot. I don't know that the court has addressed the issue of can you have a murder case without testimony from a medical examiner.
Is it an issue this panel can even reach in light of the record?
It's not our best issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Thank you, Ms. Fleck. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 1 o'clock.
All rise.